Sangye cho tang so ki cho nam la Jang chu bar du lag ni kyab su chi Da gi jun so gi pi so nam gi Jo la pen jir sangye ru par shu I go for refuge till I am enlightened. The spirits that I collect, the practice of giving, and the other perfections, may I attain the state of Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened. The Buddha is the Dharma and the assembly of saints. The virtuous spirits that I collect, the practice of giving, and the other perfections, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and craving. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents, ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Saparirvara Radha Mandala Buddha Mega Samudra Saparana Samayipan. Welcome. Clarifying the sage's intent. Sakya Pandita, master teacher of all six realm beings. Let's take a moment and just review where we've come from and where we're going. Sakya Pandita's commentary on Maitreya's text is really a roadmap from before becoming a Buddhist all the way through to enlightenment. It's sort of like a dharmic GPS. Some GPSs will show you where there's a traffic jam or where there's construction and how you should take a different route or don't go down that road. And this text is kind of like that. It not only shows you the path, it shows you the downfalls. And it shows you the remedies. So it's really a very extraordinary piece of ancient wisdom. We started out, or Sakya Pandita started out, talking about propensity, spiritual propensity. What makes one person inclined toward becoming a Buddhist and another person not to be inclined? And we went into some detail about propensity. And at a certain point, a person's propensity leads them to wanting to do Dharma practice. And so the first step in that is refuge. That's sort of the official dividing line between non-Buddhists and Buddhists. It's a major step, going for refuge and taking the refuge vow. And there's quite an extensive discussion about refuge, starting with the nature of refuge, what is refuge, we talked about, and Sakya Pandita categorizes six different types of refuge. You can do categories in a lot of different ways, but he did it in a certain way that divided it into six types, and we talked about the different types. And then, once you take refuge, what are the precepts? What are the rules that you have to do? What are the practices? Sakya Pandita talked about general precepts, which apply to all three jewels. And then there are individual precepts for each individual jewel. We talked about that. And then we talked about the benefits. Why do I want to take refuge? What do I get out of it? What are the benefits, right? And there are two types. There are temporary benefits and there are ultimate benefits. And there was a discussion about those. And then the next chapter has to do with the enlightenment thought. which is really the basis of Mahayana Great Vehicle Buddhism, commonly known as bodhicitta, or the enlightenment thought. And there's different categories for enlightenment thought. There's relative and ultimate. And the relative has two subcategories, aspiring and engaging. Then we talked about how do you produce the enlightenment thought? How do you create it? There was a discussion of the different ways that can happen, and there are different traditions about the enlightenment thought and how to produce it. The Maitreya tradition, which of course this is ultimately a Maitreya text that we're talking about here, Maitreya says there's five different ways that you can produce the enlightenment thought, and we went into the discussion about that. The other major division is the middle way, or the Madhyamaka tradition. And in the middle way tradition, there are actually four ways of doing it. So there's a lot of different ways of generating the enlightenment thought or producing it. And then once you produce the enlightenment thought, what are the precepts? What do you need to actually do? In the discussion of the precepts, there are the precepts for the aspiring enlightenment thought, there are the precepts for the engaging enlightenment thought, and there are brief explanations, there are medium-length explanations, and there are extensive explanations. So the enlightenment thought chapter is a big chapter. There's a lot of material to be covered. And it's important to note that for the ultimate enlightenment thought, that is attained only through meditative practice. There'll be more discussion about that. But in terms of what are the actual trainings that a person needs to do for the aspiring enlightenment thought, the brief training is simply this, according to the 42nd Sakyatrizin: maintaining the wish to attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. That's it. If you want it in a nutshell, that's for the aspiring enlightenment thought. For the engaging enlightenment thought, the short explanation or brief explanation is, again, according to His Holiness 42nd Sakyatrizin, he said, try to abandon negative actions and accomplish virtuous deeds as much as possible based on the aspiring enlightenment thought. So your motivation, your aspiration to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings is what motivates your actions in the engaging enlightenment thought. So try to avoid negative actions and try to do virtue as much as possible. Okay? That's the short explanation. Okay? Now we go to the medium length explanation for training in the aspiring enlightenment thought. The first thing we need to know are what are the causes for giving up the aspiring enlightenment thought. Sometimes people get into Dharma and then they give it up. Why? Well, we need to know what causes that so we can avoid it. And then once we understand the causes of giving it up, we need to understand and meditate and cultivate on the antidotes. It's like if you have a disease, you take the medicine. So in terms of the causes of giving up aspiring enlightenment thought, there are three causes why people give it up. In the beginning, when people first start out, the main cause for people to give up the aspiring enlightenment thought is what's called faint-heartedness. In other words, oh, I can't do this. It's just too much for me. I'm not a saint. I'm not a Buddha. I'm not anybody special. This whole thing is just too much. I can't do it. And that stops us performing any of the actions that we need to do in terms of the engaging enlightenment thought. We give up before we start, in other words. Sakyapandita said, some people will think, it's difficult for a person such as myself to achieve Buddhahood, and so on and so on and so on. And as a result, they don't apply themselves in the training. And he says the antidote for that is courage. Sakyapandita quotes Maitreya in the original root text, saying, "At every moment, unlimited numbers of beings who are humans are attaining perfect awakening. Therefore, do not indulge in faint-heartedness." In other words, people are becoming enlightened all the time. There's absolutely no reason at all why we can't, because we have Buddha nature. Just don't fall into this. Just have courage, you know. Last week we told the story that illustrated that, which was the seven worm sisters, and how there were seven worms who were on a piece of wood, and the wood got washed into a lake, and in the lake there was a Vairochana statue on the bottom, which is a practice that people do. They put statues in bodies of water so that the beings that are in the water can circumambulate the statue. And these seven worms, because the wind blew the stick around the statue, these seven sisters were reborn as humans from that merit alone. They were really poor, though. But in any case, they collected grass and sold it, and wood, and sold it, and they made money. And then they made offerings with that money. And as a result of that, they were reborn as disciples of the previous Buddha, which was called Kashyapa. And they became his students. And as a result of that, then they became enlightened. So that's pretty fast. And the point there being, we should not, first of all, you should not give up. But secondly, you should not underrate small meritorious activities, especially in regard to holy objects. And there are extensive writings about the benefits of holy objects and the power of holy objects. I mean, we have dozens of them here. These objects, they're blessed. Very often they have mantras in them or special objects in them or blessed objects in them, which contain a blessing power which you can't really see, but you can see if you look at the results that happen. And this story is an example. And then there was another story in Sakyapandita's about there was a pig who was chased by a dog. He was chased around the stupa three times. And then as a result of that, the pig was reborn in a higher rebirth and went on. So even activity that isn't motivated with dharmic motivation by the power of the object can have a tremendous result. So don't be discouraged. Have courage. If you have Buddha nature, it's possible. And that's something that sometimes beginners are subject to, is just, well, I can't do this. Now, there's another kind of thing that can cause people to give up the enlightenment thought, and that happens usually later when they've been practicing for a while. Typically, a situation like that would be, for example, my friend is sick. I'm going to say lots of mantras. I'm going to do healing pujas for my friend. And then, boom, my friend dies. Oh, the downfall would be to think, oh, this doesn't work. This Dharma stuff, it's not really that effective. It's not powerful. And, of course, that's a mistake. And we're going to go into some more detail about why that's a mistake. But just to give you the antidote, it's joyous enthusiasm. Remember the six perfections? Joyous enthusiasm is one of them. So pump up your joy, pump up your enthusiasm. Ape Rinpoche, who wrote a commentary on this text, went into quite some detail about explaining why it is sometimes practices don't work. Don't work is in quotation marks. Ape Rinpoche gave the example of the person who dies. I prayed for my friend, but he died anyway. And he went into some detail about this, saying that we need to understand that when somebody dies, there are seven possible causes for that. we've talked before about the causes for life are few and the causes for death are many. Well, he lists 7 causes. There are 3 main ones, which are the exhaustion of life force, the exhaustion of your past life good karma, and the exhaustion of your merits. Any one of these can be the cause of death if they're completely exhausted. But also, any 2 or 3 in combination can cause death. If you add those together, you have the first 3, that's 3, and then you have the first one and the second one, and then you have the first one and the third one, and then you have the second one and the third one, and then you have all 3, that totals 7. So any combination of those can cause death. And so you need to realize that it's really easy to die. Life is just really tenuous. However, there are antidotes. There are solutions. So if your life force is exhausted, you could perform a long life ritual, which are, there are long life deities, such as Amitayas or Ushnisha Vijaya. These are practices for long life. You can do those practices. In some cases, life will be restored. In other words, you don't die. If your karma is exhausted, the antidote for that is to do live release practices. So an animal who's destined to be killed, for example, a slaughter, you know, for food, or a fish in a restaurant tank, or a lobster, you can ransom those animals, you can buy the animal, and instead of eating it, you bless it and release it out into the wild. That extends your karma, your life karma. So that's a possible antidote. If your merit is exhausted, well, there's all kinds of things you can do to generate merit. For example, you can make offerings to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. You can recite the scriptures. You can make offerings to the Sangha, the spiritual community. You can practice generosity by giving to those who are needy. You can make food offerings to worldly spirits. Or you can substitute your non-virtue with virtue. So say you have a bad habit, you're a chronic pickpocket, or you lie a lot, or you have some really bad habit. You can recognize that, hopefully. And then substitute a positive action. So if you steal a lot, you can then practice generosity. So that's another possibility. It's all in your mind, of course. And interestingly enough, one of the practices in this category is taking your medicine. Take your darn medicine, the doctor gave you, you know. So that's considered a Dharma practice in that context. Yeah, so you can do that. Now, if only one of those elements is exhausted, then you can restore your life, so to speak. In other words, you don't die. But if 2 of them are exhausted, then it takes a really great effort to overcome those, because obviously you've got 2 that you have to work with. But if all 3 are exhausted, that's it. Game over. Nobody can stop your death, even the Buddha.
And what were they again? Merit and...
Karma, merit, and life force. Okay. So, moral of the story is, you prayed for your friend and your friend died. That doesn't mean that these techniques or practices don't work. You should not give up your enlightenment thought because of that. That's not a good reason. His Holiness 42nd Sakya Treason said, and I'm quoting him here, if we don't see the results of our Dharma practice, we should check into our motivation and how we do the practice. If we don't have the right motivation to practice the Dharma, then no matter how much time and energy you put into it, it won't yield any good results. And furthermore, even if we do have the right motivation and practice genuine Dharma, sometimes the result can only be seen in the next life or after several lifetimes. And we should therefore check ourselves at all times and carefully examine what our motivation is. With the right motivation and the proper practice, positive results are bound to happen. It's just a matter of time. Apa Rinpoche elaborates on this point by saying, really, there are three types of karma. And remember, karma is one of these topics that only the Buddha understands fully. But we understand some of it, and we can say, as he says, there are three types of karma. The strongest type of karma presents itself in this lifetime. The next strongest karma presents itself in the next lifetime. And then any weaker karma will present in future lifetimes. And for a result to present itself in this lifetime, several conditions have to be met. First of all, the action that you're doing has to be extremely powerful. For example, if you're saying a mantra, there's like lots of mantras. It has to be a really powerful mantra for the situation that you're dealing with. So that's the first thing that has to happen. And by the way, this is for positive or negative actions. And then the second thing is the recipient of the action must be extraordinary. For example, a Buddha or an Arhat or your parents in this life. We have very strong karmic connection with our parents, this life parents, and actions done negatively or positively towards your parents carry extreme karmic weight. So that's another requirement. It has to be an extraordinary recipient. The third thing is that your motivation must be absolutely overwhelming. It must be super strong, your motivation. And therefore, as a result, according to Apa Rinpoche, it's very unusual for a result to arise in this lifetime. Apologies to John Lennon for writing the song Instant Karma. Instant karma is really rare. We might think we see instant karma. You see videos, somebody's driving crazy, and then they crash, and they say, oh, instant karma. Not really. It's a coincidence. They were just driving poorly. It isn't really that simple. There's other factors here that have to come into play before you get a direct, immediate result. He says the reason why the results of practice cannot arise immediately is that the result arises only from the complete assembly of all causes and all conditions. The result simply cannot arise unless all the causes and conditions converge. And he says this is really good in a way because we are constantly doing non-virtue. We have negative thoughts and things. And if the result was immediate, we would be devastated. We would be in pain and suffering all the time. So it's actually probably a good thing that it doesn't happen right away. Because negative karma can be purified with purification practices. If we catch it before it manifests, we can eliminate it. So it's actually good that things don't, that there isn't really instant karma. Dzongtsa Khyentse Rinpoche gave an example one time to illustrate this point. He said, if you're sitting at a pond and you see a swan in the pond, the swan will have certain characteristics. It'll be a certain size. It'll be, you know, certain gender, certain color, certain characteristics. He said, that swan had parents. And those parents had parents, so this swan had grandparents, and then there were great-grandparents, and then great-great-grandparent swans. He said, you might have to go back like seven generations before you can see the result in this swan that has a certain type of feather. He said, it's virtually impossible to really understand the conditions that create the manifestation of karma, because for karma to manifest, there has to be the karma, but there also have to be the conditions. And the condition is kind of the joker in the deck, so to speak, because unless all of those conditions are there, It doesn't manifest. The karma, the seed, is still there. And when the conditions come about, then it will manifest. What we need to do is realize we have a whole karma bank full of positive and negative seeds. We don't really know what, because we're not clairvoyant enough to know. But we want to do purification practices because chances are there's some negative seeds in there. I mean, we're not enlightened yet, so we want to take care of those negative seeds by purifying them so that they don't meet the conditions and then manifest. So that's a kind of extensive explanation about why there isn't instant karma, except in rare circumstances. However, there are karmas and conditions that do manifest and how they work. Those are the first two causes of why people give up the enlightenment thought, but there is a third cause, and we're going to read about it directly. And this cause, the third cause, is called the fear of worldly existence. And this section is overcoming the wish to abandon enlightenment thought through the fear of worldly existence. And Apri Rinpoche says, some Mahayana followers may give up their enlightenment thought altogether for fear of having to experience great hardships. They may not believe they will be able to respond peacefully when somebody harms them, and they might think that they may be consequently be stuck in the suffering of cyclic existence for a very long time. However, if a person harms us, we should understand that by harming him in return, we only create further suffering. Therefore, whenever we experience harm, we should respond with compassion and loving kindness. And in this way, we're able to neutralize any harm that's done to us. We must meditate on this. We should call to mind that this world, including the outer world, its inhabitants, and our inner experiences, is, by its very nature, unreal. It has no existence of its own. It's like a magician's creation. If we understand this, we can overcome fear of worldly suffering. Some may think that it takes too long to reach enlightenment for the benefit of others, and they may not be prepared to stay around for the duration. If we're in danger of losing enlightenment thought because of the length of time that it takes to practice on the path, we should endeavor to understand what actually constitutes an eon and what constitutes a moment. We should meditate on this. In this way, we will discover that there is ultimately no difference between an eon and an instant. Long and short are just conceptualizations, lacking inherent existence. In ultimate reality, time does not even exist. Yet another way to overcome the wish to give up the enlightenment thought is through praying to the Buddhas, to the great Bodhisattvas, or to our personal deities. In short, through techniques such as these, we can overcome any inclination to relinquish the enlightenment thought. There is no time in ultimate reality. That's why you can dedicate your merit in advance, which I recommend. Hey, you might forget, you know, and then you lose it. Kenpo Jordan explained that to me. Sakyapandita says on this topic, abandoning the thought of awakening through dread of the faults of cyclic existence. Here you see that the sufferings of birth, old age, sickness, and death, and are vexed by the ingratitude of evil people you have treated well. You therefore abandon the thought of attaining awakening for the sake of all sentient beings because you despair of remaining in cyclic existence for many eons. But there are antidotes to this. You can dispel it by understanding that these defiling personal aggregates, in other words, your skandhas, they are like an illusion. And by cultivating the attitude of love towards sentient beings that a parent has towards an only child. These are techniques. That was two techniques, okay? Understand that your skandhas are illusory, cultivating love towards sentient beings, discerning wisdom that perceives no difference between an eon and an instant, and that realizes that the three times, past, present, and future, are actually without time. Also, you will be able to avoid abandoning the thought of awakening by meditating on your spiritual preceptor, your tutelary deities, and by means of prayers, dedicating the roots of virtue. An example of this occurred in the life of Master Dignaga. When he was about to abandon the thought of awakening, he was prevented from doing so by his tutelary deity, Manjushri. The teacher here should appropriately elaborate about these things in more detail. So I will elaborate in more detail here about Dignaga's story, which is kind of interesting. Dignaga was born as the son of a very rich and powerful king in southern India. When he grew up, he renounced the princely life and entered a Buddhist order. This order followed one of the foundation traditions, which maintained the view of a truly existent self. Now, Dignaga had heard that the concept of a real self was not accepted in Buddhism. But nevertheless, as this was the view held by the abbot of his monastery, he was reluctant to contradict him. And in case he himself might be mistaken, he decided to give this theory of the existence of a personal self the benefit of the doubt. So he began to carry out some investigations. In order to see better during the day, he opened four new windows in his room and burned four lamps at night. And then he undertook a meticulous and protracted examination of his body to see whether he could locate this self that his abbot taught about. At times, he would even remove all of his clothes and stand naked in front of the mirror. But however much he searched, he could not find his self. Some of the other monks in the monastery noticed this strange behavior and reported him to the abbot. So the abbot sent for Dignaga and told him that since he had renounced the world, he should behave properly and stop acting so strangely in his room. Dignaga told the abbot he'd been trying to find his self, and the abbot had spoken about it, and he thought that his own impure vision might have been obstructing him from seeing it. Afterwards, though, he made four new windows and burned even more lamps in an effort to find his self. But since he was still unable to find it, he informed his abbot that the view of the existence of a self must be incorrect. The abbot, however, replied, "All the other monks in the monastery have accepted this view of the self, and yet you have denied it, and you have developed a negative, nihilistic view. That being the case, it would be better if you leave." So, Dignaga decided to go up into the mountains and meditate. On the way, he met another prince who noticed the sign of a wheel on Dignaga's foot. And he told him that if he were to become a king, he would be very powerful. And he was willing to give half of his kingdom to Dignaga if he would agree to join him. But Dignaga told him that he could see no point in ruling a kingdom within worldly existence or wielding worldly power. Instead, Dignaga found a cave where he embarked on studying and meditating the teachings of the Buddha. And during his study, he realized that one would have to consult a great number of texts in order to learn the meanings of Buddha's words. So he decided to collect all these teachings together into a condensed format. First, he wrote some small texts containing Buddha's logic. He first wrote a message telling Buddha of his intention and placed this message on the wall of the cave. As he did this, many wonderful signs, such as earthquakes, appeared, and the entire area was bathed in light. A Hindu scholar and meditator saw the signs. Through his clairvoyant powers, he learned that Dignaga was going to write a substantial book on logic. And he realized that if he did so, it might harm the non-Buddhist schools. So, whenever Dignaga left to go collect alms, the scholar would use his powers to erase everything that Dignaga had written. And every time he did this, Dignaga would rewrite it. This happened 3 times. On the 4th day, Dignaga left a message inviting the person who had been erasing his verses to meet him and explain his reasons for doing so. So that day, the scholar waited for Dignaga, and when Dignaga returned to the cave, the two debated about the correct view of ultimate reality. Dignaga won the debate. And according to the custom at the time, he insisted that the Hindu scholar renounce his religion immediately and convert to Buddhism. But the scholar refused. Instead, he used his supernatural powers to emit an enormous flame from his mouth, which singed Dignaga's hair and beard. And though the power was so powerful that it consumed even the trees that were outside the cave, it did not harm Dignaga, because he had produced the enlightenment thought. And after this, the scholar flew away. And later, Dignaga reflected that in return for all of his work for the Dharma, his hair and beard had been singed. And despite his good motivation for debating, he had been unable to convert even a single person. Therefore, how could there be any point in trying to gain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings? And thinking in this way, he wrote a message on a piece of wood stating his intention to give up the enlightenment thought. He tossed the piece of wood high into the air, and he resolved that from the very moment the wood landed, he would give up his enlightenment thought and never work for the sake of sentient beings again. But the piece of wood did not land on the ground. And when Dignaga looked up into the sky to see what had happened, he saw Manjushri holding it. And he asked Manjushri why he had taken a hold of it. And Manjushri replied by inquiring, what was he doing? And Dignaga explained what had happened. And then Manjushri requested Dignaga not to give up his enlightenment thought, and he promised to stay with him and act as his spiritual guide until Dignaga had attained the first bhumi, which is a very high level, which we will talk about the bhumis later, but it's a very, very high level of spiritual attainment, the first bhumi. Manjushri said that Dignaga's philosophical writings were extremely valuable and that he should continue his work because it would benefit many sentient beings. And in fact, to this very day, Dignaga's writings on logic are studied in the philosophical colleges as primary texts that were written in this cave. This is to illustrate, if you have any doubts, pray to your deity. And your deity will help you. That finishes the medium explanation. What follows is the extensive explanation in detail, which has three parts, starting with the aspiring enlightenment thought, the cause for developing it, the conditions for increasing it, and the method for keeping it from declining. So the cause for developing the aspiring enlightenment thought is actually a couple: loving kindness and great compassion. Where have we heard that before? Ape Rinpoche says you need to generate those thoughts in your mind. And Sakya Pandita says that because those are the causes for developing aspiring enlightenment thought, you should really exert yourself in cultivating them. His Holiness, the 42nd Sakya Treason, says that compassion actually has many levels. Here we're talking about great compassion, which means compassion for all sentient beings, which are countless in numbers. And therefore, our compassion is infinite. This is generally known in the Great Vehicle as great compassion. That is, it's compassion towards all sentient beings equally and without any discrimination at all. It's the wish for all sentient beings to be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. So, of course, it's not enough to wish that beings are free from suffering, because if we don't wish that they're free from the causes, they'll just keep creating the causes and continue to suffer. It has to be both, suffering and the causes of suffering. Sakya Treason says we should develop the same attitude towards loving kindness. So in other words, we should generate great loving kindness, so towards all sentient beings without any discrimination. And he says we must therefore begin by cultivating these two positive thoughts in meditation with great diligence in order to eventually develop pure enlightenment thought. So those are the causes. And then there are seven conditions that increase the aspiring enlightenment thought. The first one is to rely on a true spiritual teacher who can explain the Dharma and someone who has actually practiced it. It's not enough to just study. You also have to meditate. Listening, contemplation, meditation. The second condition for increasing aspiring enlightenment thought is to develop desiring faith and believing faith. In the course last summer, we talked about faith and the different kinds of faith. So in general, there are three kinds of faith. There's clear faith, desiring faith, and believing faith. Here we're talking about the last two, desiring and believing. So clear faith means thinking about the infinite qualities of the three jewels, especially those of the Buddha. But in this context, it refers to thinking about the great qualities of the enlightenment thought and be deeply inspired by them. So we've talked in the past about these. So that's what clear faith is, just to review that. But here we're talking about desiring and believing faith. So desiring faith is the wish to attain the qualities of the enlightenment thought for the sake of all being. So we desire it. Yeah. Believing faith, on the other hand, is confident trust in the qualities of the three jewels. In other words, being completely free of doubt or uncertainty about the three jewels. And it also includes the strong belief that if we rely on the three jewels, we'll never be deceived, that we can be free from the ocean of cyclic existence and eventually attain the state of Buddhahood. Developing faith is the second condition for increasing your aspiring enlightenment thought. Third one is to know and avoid the actions of evil spirits. Now this topic requires some explanation. About this, His Holiness 42nd Sakya Treason says, actions of evil spirits means the obstacles that cause disharmony between the teacher and the disciple. And it's important that we identify these obstacles in order to abandon them. So that's one way of looking at it. Ape Rinpoche goes into some detail from another point of view. And these obstacles are what are sometimes referred to as the Maras. You may have heard the Buddha's story where he was sitting under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya and about to attain enlightenment, and the Maras came and tried to distract him and stop him from his meditation. The head Mara sent beings to seduce him. That didn't work. They sent evil spirits to attack him. That didn't work. There was this whole series of attacks from the Maras. So the Maras have sort of a different... They kind of take different forms in different situations. And so Ape Rinpoche describes this as being fourfold. And you might read about the four Maras. So the first Mara is the Mara of the defilements. So our own defilements. Anger, ignorance, jealousy, miserliness, and so on. Our negativity is a form of obstacle for us. It's a type of devil, if you like. But it's not out there, it's in us. So that's the first type of Mara. The second type of Mara is the Mara of aggregates, meaning defiled aggregates, such as body and mind, which arise due to the defilements and due to conceiving things as inherently existent. So we've talked about aggregates as form, feeling, perception, concepts, and consciousness. So the pieces that go together to make up us, which we falsely label as ego, those are actually Maras. They are defiled. They're not pure. So that's another type of Mara. We need to recognize that they're not inherently existent. How? Through meditation. The third Mara is simply death. Death is simply the exhaustion of karma and conditions, which we just talked about earlier. So that's another type of Mara. Death is definitely an obstacle. And then the fourth one is known as the Son of the God. And I haven't been able to find out exactly why that got translated that way. But this is what we normally call demons. These are beings that are reborn in the spirit realm with negative propensities who don't want our practice to succeed. They're the dark side. They don't want us to go to the light side. They obstruct those who are engaged in the Dharma path for the purposes of defeating the first three Maras. So we do Dharma to defeat the first three Maras, but the evil spirits don't want that, so they obstruct us, and they become the fourth type of Mara. This becomes really important once you get into practicing, because this definitely happens. And that's why we have Dharma protectors, we have protector spirits and protector gods, both enlightened and non-enlightened. Mahakala, Vajrapani, and others. And particularly in the Sakya school, it's important to develop your Mahakala practice and your Vajrapani practice to prevent problems in your Dharma practice. And in the Sakya school tradition, the first retreat that normally somebody does is the Vajrapani retreat. And that's to protect your practice. I've done public talks and so on where people in the audience say, well, I don't believe in spirits. I don't believe in demons. Okay. That's fine. The answer that I have sometimes given is that in Buddhism, we recognize that everything out there is a projection of our mind. So if there is an evil spirit out there, that's a negative fault that I have. That's another way of looking at it. And that generally satisfies those people that don't believe in demons, because they recognize that, yeah, our mind is powerful. So I just mentioned that if you run into a situation where somebody says, well, I don't believe in that stuff, that's just superstition. Okay. Well, right off the bat, you know they haven't meditated very much, because a person that meditates a lot has definitely had these kind of experiences, and they know darn well that it's not just superstition. However, it's also true that everything is a projection of our mind, right? So, I mean, we've studied that too. So, you can look at a lot of these things from different ways, and you hopefully find one that works for you and for your skeptic friend. So, those are the Maras, and I think what I'll do now is ask if there are questions. Yes.
What does Mara translate to?
Devil, demon.
Bedevilment, rather than a thing, it's a process, it's a bedevilment.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Which, I mean, I'm not a translator, but I believe that's the way it's rendered, right? Do you agree, Karen?
Yes.
Uh-huh, okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, there are some more on this list for increasing. I think we'll leave that for next time. If there aren't any more questions, we'll say our dedication. So nam de tam jesi pani tob na ne pe da nam pam jete ke ga na ji ba lung tru pe Sibbe sole dua ju varsho Jang ju sem ju grim ho che Ma ke pa nam ke gyur che Ke ma nyam pa me par yung Gong ne gong tu pel par sho Jam pa pa o ji tar ken pa dam Gun tu sang po de yong de jin de De da kung gi ji zu da lo ji Ge wa di da tam je ra tu Tu su che pi gya wa tam che ki Ngo wa gang la ju du ngā pa li Ta jen ge we tsa wa di gun kya Sang po jo che rab du ngō Chak sa wa dang cho shing sha pa dang Jesu yi rong gu shing so wa yi Ge wa chung ze da gi chi sak pa Tam che zok pa jang chu chi By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious, may it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen, may it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way, Valiant, Manjushri, and Samantha Bhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I might train to be like them. Through this dedication, praised as supreme, by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever I have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you.
Thank you.